Susan dropped her forehead into her hands. The act could be read as exhaustion or regret. Gabby could definitely sympathize with the exhaustion. She could also understand, if not fully empathize with, how the anxious and seemingly sensitive woman in front of her had been thrown into a murderous rage. "I get how you must have felt," she said to Susan. "I'm married, and I can't imagine what I'd do if one of my neighbors, a woman I'd considered a friend no less, went after my husband." Gabby ducked her head, trying to look Susan in the eye. "I'd do more than tell her to back off in an email, that's for sure. I'd confront her face to face, make sure she knew how serious I was about protecting my family." Susan drove her fingers into her hair, pulling back the pieces that had dried stringy from a hasty rinse, likely in one of the station bathrooms. "I wish I hadn't sent that stupid message. I was being overly sensitive. Rachel wasn't after Nadal."
"Did she tell you that when you confronted her?"
Susan dropped her arms and straightened her neck. The eyes that met Gabby's were hard as marbles. "I didn't confront her."
"Come on, Susan. Do you really think anyone will believe that? She was after your husband."
Susan rolled her eyes. "Nope. I had a few scotches with Lewis in the backyard. Afterward, I sent that email and then passed out on the couch."
"The couch?"
Gabby had expected Susan to claim to have slept beside her husband, thereby establishing an alibi. Instead, her suspect had confessed to sleeping alone. Susan had either slipped up, or she'd consciously come clean because she knew Nadal wouldn't lie for her. Or perhaps she suspected that someone, likely Ben, had seen her on the couch. Whatever her reason, though, she'd just admitted to lacking a verifiable alibi for the time of Rachel's murder. Gabby softened her tone, aiming for a kind of sisterly sympathy that might stoke a confession.
"I understand that you now think you overreacted. At 12:15 a.m., though, you thought Rachel was after your husband, a man you've been married to for over a decade, right? With whom you have two children. You'd have been understandably upset. I would have been. Any woman would have been. You would have wanted to tell her to back off in person. And I could understand how things would go awry. Rachel was argumentative, clearly. She'd already had a huge public fight with her husband. I can imagine her getting defensive instead of apologizing like a decent person. What did she do on that jetty?"
Gabby lowered her voice to a conspiratorial level. "Scream at you? Push you? That's really how you cut your foot, isn't it?" Susan's lips were pressed together like a stamp on an ink pad. Gabby read the strained body language as a desperate effort to contain the truth. The confession was at the tip of Susan's tongue, fighting to be freed.
"I'd understand if you pushed her into the water. I really would. If it were me, I'd have wanted to knock her off her perch, too."
Gabby searched Susan's eyes for confirmation, but saw only the same flinty stare.
"Or maybe, even worse, she shoved you, and you pulled her down with you. You had to defend yourself. She'd screwed up her own marriage, and now she wanted yours. She was threatening to steal your husband, destroy your family, take your boy's father."
Gabby trailed off, giving Susan a chance to fill in the ellipses. The woman inhaled until her chest threatened to tear her tank top. Gabby suppressed a smile. "Here we go."
"Thank you for outlining the prosecution's case against me."
Susan sat back in her chair. The distressed demeanor Gabby had witnessed since that morning vanished.
"Now I understand what I'll be dealing with if this nonsense ever makes it to court, which I very much doubt."
She folded her arms across her chest.
"I'm invoking my right to remain silent and my right to an attorney. This interrogation is over, as is my stay here, unless you arrest me. As I believe that is your intention, I request to speak to my husband. Since he is here as a voluntary witness, I ask that you send him in so that I may inform him of my whereabouts and have him contact an attorney. I'm certain one of my former colleagues at Youngblood, Abramson, and Dershowitz will take the case. No doubt Youngblood herself. The name of the famous defense attorney was a slap across the face. Thanks to several high-profile celebrity cases, Youngblood was known nationwide, not just for winning cases at trial, but for getting charges dismissed before the court even convened. She'd become famous for getting cases thrown out for violations of the right to a speedy trial, insufficient evidence, and questionable handling of evidence. Gabby gawked at the former emotional wreck before her. She'd made a grave mistake, she realized. When Detective DeMarco had asked Susan's profession, she'd said only that she homeschooled her autistic son. Gabby hadn't given much thought to what the woman had done for a living prior to becoming a stay-at-home mom. If anything, she'd assumed she'd probably been a teacher or a child psychologist. She certainly hadn't thought lawyer. Attorneys couldn't be handled like average suspects. The typical guilty person could be cowed by a good story or cajoled into a confession simply by an authority figure showing some sympathy for a violent reaction. But lawyers knew that whatever story the police and prosecution crafted, no matter how compelling and logical, was no more than a fairy tale unless backed by facts. Gabby had unwittingly revealed that all she had against Susan was a motive theory, a nasty email, some blood in the backyard, and a lack of an alibi witness. Without a confession, the circumstantial case would barely be sufficient to press charges, let alone win a jury trial, especially if Youngblood was the attorney. Gabby slammed the door behind her as she exited the room, furious with herself for misjudging the fellow mom. She stormed past the cubicles and into the corridor, heading to the soft interrogation room, where Detective DeMarco was no doubt grilling Nadal about his relationship with the deceased. Before throwing the door back, she peered through its transom window. Nadal sat on the couch with his hands in his lap, while DeMarco glared at him from a corner of the room. Given that Nadal's wife had been a criminal defense attorney, Gabby suspected he'd demanded a lawyer as soon as DeMarco had finished Mirandizing him. Gabby flung open the door. "Interview over?" DeMarco shot Nadal a sideways glance. "He exercised his right to silence before saying hello. He's demanding his attorney." "Well, she's in interrogation one," Gabby quipped. DeMarco's expression cursed for him. "That's convenient." Nadal didn't react to the conversation being conducted in front of him. He sat on the couch, like he was waiting outside a hospital room, hands folded, head bowed. "If you would come with me," Gabby said, "your wife would like to speak with you. We intend to arrest her for the murder of Rachel Klein." Nadal shot up. "That's insane." The uncontrolled emotion evident in the abrupt movement gave Gabby an idea. An incensed non-lawyer might not be careful with his words, particularly if he thought he was defending his wife or his honor. Since he'd asked for a lawyer, Gabby couldn't ask him any questions related to the case. However, there was no law stating that Gabby couldn't inform him of his wife's situation, encouraging him to let slip whatever had led Susan to discover the affair, or mistakenly believe there'd been one. "Well, her motive's not so crazy. She thought you were sleeping with Rachel." Gabby kept her voice level, as though she had the evidence to back it up. That would be a lot for any wife to handle, especially given that the other woman had pretended to be her friend and lived next door. Nadal shook his head like an obstinate child.
"Susan knows that's not true."
Gabby smirked.
"We have that email, and she's not denying it."
"Because she's protecting me."
Nadal threw his hands out, too upset to rein in his gestures.
"The email wasn't about an affair."
"I don't believe that."
Gabby raised her voice, turning up the room temperature.
"I read it. Anyone that reads it, it was about work." Nadal stood like an evangelical preacher appealing to the crowd, both palms out to invoke the good Lord.
Work! The whole damn thing was concerning a case. I can show you the damn document.
Chapter 22, The Day Of. Jenny opened the front door barely wide enough to slip through sideways. She rushed through the hallway, compensating for the squeak of her sneakers on the concrete floor with speed. When she reached the end of the corridor, she hovered there and squinted at the far wall of windows. If Lewis wasn't outside, she'd have to forego her medications. She couldn't risk another fight in a locked bedroom. Susan sat at the outdoor dining table, clearly exposed by the moonlight and glow from the pool. She watched someone swimming. Jenny recognized the arms breaking above the water. Lewis was doing laps, releasing his anger with a new exercise, given that he'd knocked out his sparring partner. He wouldn't see her while face down in the water. Still, Jenny stuck to the shadowed area under the second floor loft, emerging into the light only to race up the open staircase. She turned down the hallway to the master suite and rushed to the bedroom. It appeared as she'd left it, lit by moonlight, the bed must, but made. She could discern the impression of her prone body in the duvet, an inverted chalk outline in the puffy ground. Deep divots flanked the concave center where Lewis had placed his knees. The sight increased her determination to get her medications and get out of there. She ran to the bathroom, her heartbeat throbbing in her inflamed throat. The bottles were visible where she'd left them on the wide rim of the pedestal sink. Their labels, however, were not. She pressed down one of the bottle's childproof caps with the heel of her hand and twisted it off. It was too risky to turn on a light, so, like a blind woman, she confirmed the nature of the pill by touch, tracing her finger on the round face to feel the letters OP stamped on the surface. The acronym stood for OxyContin Perdue, the brand manufacturer. She thought of it as an abbreviation for opiate, or a cipher for what it could accomplish in sufficient quantities, obliterate pain. She chewed the pill, grinding up the time-release coating between her back teeth to hasten the effects. The medicine coated her tongue, a bitter paste that might have made her retch if the taste hadn't been so familiar. Given the tolerance she'd built up over the past 5 years, one pill wouldn't do much more than soothe her neck and perhaps file down the edges of her anxiety. If she really wanted to feel nothing, she'd need far more. Later, she promised herself. Ben still had another hour or so before he could pass a breathalyzer test, and she wasn't the best night driver. She needed to remain alert until she could hand over the wheel. After that, she could take another couple of pills to really take the edge off. Once at Ben's house, she could swallow an Ambien too, enabling her to get a head-clearing sleep and wake up refreshed for all the daunting tasks ahead. Moving her money into a private account, securing an apartment somewhere that Lewis wouldn't immediately suspect, finding a divorce lawyer, and confessing the abuse to Allie. The thought of her daughter delivered a harsh dose of reality. Jenny couldn't go to Ben's house for a good night's sleep. She needed him to take her to the airport. If Jenny knew her husband, and after 15 years together, she did. He'd be heading to Allie's camp within 36 hours, as soon as he realized she'd taken off. She couldn't let him get to their daughter first. Jenny raced to the stairs, gripping the railing as she sprinted down the steps. Within minutes, she was out the front door, shells crunching beneath her feet. She expected to hear the beep of doors unlocking as she reached the Suburban. When she didn't, she knocked on the side panel and then rounded the vehicle, pressing her face to the driver's side window so that Ben could see she'd arrived. The door still didn't unlock. Through the tinted glass, she saw a vacant driver's seat and no one in the shotgun position. Her panic swelled like an incoming tide, rising with every second she remained exposed and alone on the driveway. Jenny tried forcing it back with excuses. Ben must have gone to grab some things from his own room. She'd run through the first floor hallway so quickly that he didn't realize she was waiting outside. If she took a deep breath, he'd be there. But her chest felt too constricted to breathe. Jenny slunk to the opposite side of the car, the one that would be less visible should Lewis, not Ben, exit the front door looking for her. The moon shone like a searchlight. She pulled her phone from her purse and began checking flights to Maine from the East Hampton Airport. The earliest one was at 6 a.m. and had a stop, making it take 5 hours. JFK International was an hour's drive and a much larger airport. Shells cracked to her left as she typed in the new search. Jenny whirled toward the sound, flinging her heart into her esophagus. Ben, she thought. Please be Ben. The sight of the massive shadow blurred her vision. She launched herself toward it, throwing her arms around his waist and pressing her lips to the neck level with her face. I wasn't sure if you changed your mind. He pushed against her shoulders. Her sneakers skidded back over the shells. Why did you do it? Jenny caught the shimmer of Ben's teeth between his lips. The grin didn't match the harsh tone of his question. He wasn't smiling, Jenny realized. He was sneering. Do what? She reached for him a second time, grabbing the side of his shirt before he could wrest himself away. I don't know what you're talking about. He yanked the fabric from her fist. Don't, Jen. I talked to Rachel. I wanted to tell her I was leaving. I owed her that. She told me that she knew I was cheating.
Well, you told her to sleep with other people. She probably guessed.
She knew every excruciating detail of our first time, except, conveniently, for your name.
Ben backed away, extending his arm from his body like a running back trying to block a tackle. Jenny heard a crack as shells crunched beneath his feet.
It makes sense now why she was livid at dinner. You'd told her. You'd emailed or texted that you'd seen me with someone, and she got the message when she went inside. Of course, you didn't say with who.
No, Ben, I—
Against the window in my office.
Ben's voice was so loud, it seemed to echo in the open air.
I'm trying to understand why you'd be so brutal, Jen. The only reason I can come up with is that you'd had enough of Lewis and wanted to make sure that Rachel left me too, so that I'd be waiting for you.
Jenny pressed a finger to her lips, silently begging him to lower his voice before Lewis heard. Ben ignored her plea, nearly shouting her name.
But it backfired, Jen. Rachel is on the warpath. She's going to argue against joint custody. She plans to say that I exposed myself to the kids by having sex in the house while they were home, in full view of the windows. She's going to paint me as a sexual deviant.
The moonlight transformed Ben's handsome face into a tragedy mask.
I knew she'd want the house and to fight alimony. I was prepared for that, but not my kids. Not my kids, Jen.
Ben's volume added a physical force to his speech, turning every sentence into a blow. Jenny's legs shook from absorbing the impact, threatening to give way at any moment.
I didn't do it!
The denial burned through her inflamed throat, emerging like a soft puff of smoke.
Please believe me. Please!
Again, she flung herself toward him, praying that he'd catch her and remember the love he'd professed less than 15 minutes earlier, that the feel of her shivering body would convince him she was innocent. Ben jumped back. She stumbled into the empty space he'd occupied.
I would have given up everything for you, Jen. Everything but my kids. I'm a father first.
He pointed at her chest.
Rachel said the only way she'd consider not fighting joint custody was if I told her who I'd slept with.
He sniffed.
You didn't leave me any choice.
Her legs finally buckled. Shards of shells stabbed Jenny's knees, but the pain was nothing compared to what would come. If Rachel knew, it was only a matter of time before Lewis did too.
I love you, Ben. Please.
Jenny's kneeling position emphasized her begging. She needed Ben's strength to help her do what was required to escape from Lewis.
You have to take us away from here. I have to get to an airport, to Maine. I have to tell Allie before he—
I can't. I can't lose my kids.
Ben retreated to the Suburban's driver's side door.
I can't be here right now, Jen.
Jenny watched him slide into the cab. She heard the engine rumble, the tires crunch against the crushed shell drive. Her mind didn't really register any of it, though. Instead, it pulsed with a looping logic. If Rachel tells Lewis, then Lewis will kill me. He'll kill me. He'll kill me. Fear forced her upright. She took off at full speed through the scrub forest, not stopping to swipe at the shell splinters digging into her knees. Sand exploded beneath her feet, bushes cut into her bare legs. She fought through it all, refusing to let anything in the rough terrain slow her down. Allie needed her mother, and Jenny was running for her life. Chapter 23, The Morning of. The rising sun shattered Susan's alcohol-induced coma. Her eyes fluttered open to the unfamiliar sight of a white coffee table. Susan recalled that her last conscious act had been to slump on the great room couch, the firm cushion of which pressed against her cramped thighs. She shoved her hands into the scratchy woven fabric and pushed herself upright. Sitting swirled the poisons in her stomach. Panting breaths failed to quell her nausea. Why had she drunk so much? She leaned back into the couch. She knew why she'd drunk so much. A glance through the glass wall revealed that it was too early to rise on vacation. The sun was merely a suggestion on the horizon, little more than a peach haze evaporating into violet clouds. A pastel promise of a pleasant beach day. Susan cursed the fair weather. She had to confront her husband of 12 years about his affair. A swirling hurricane would have been a better backdrop. The current view simply mocked her. Her heart pounded with the demand for more alcohol to dull her headache. She knew better than to listen to it. Water was the only liquid capable of flushing the toxins from her system. The whine of her belly begged her to reconsider as she grasped the sofa arm and hoisted herself into a standing position. Vomit lurched into the base of her throat. She slapped her palm over her mouth and sprinted to the sink, holding in the contents long enough to hurl them into the metal basin. By the time she stopped vomiting, all the liquid seemed wrung out of her system. With the last of her energy, she turned the faucet full blast until every chunk and trace was forced down into the pipes. She tilted her head beneath the spigot, filled her mouth with water, spat, and filled it again. The third time, she swallowed, despite the lingering flavor of last night's refuse. The liquid hit her stomach like a rock dropped in a full puddle, threatening to splash vomit back into her mouth. She kept everything down by guzzling the water until the nausea was replaced with the uncomfortable pressure of bloat. After splashing cool water on her face, she turned off the faucet, took a deep breath, and started toward the stairs. Her injured foot throbbed as she walked, reminding her of the physical wound Rachel had inflicted in addition to the psychic ones. She mumbled epithets as she ascended the stairs, compensating for the tenderness in her heel by leaning heavily on the banister. Nadal's snore greeted her as she slipped into the room. He lay atop the sheets on one side of the bed, preserving her rightful place beside him. Boxer shorts covered his backside. A latte-colored arm spilled slightly into her space, as though waiting for the body that it usually snuggled in the mornings. Or perhaps any warm body, as the email proved. Nadal wasn't choosy. Part of Susan wanted to grab her unused pillow and beat him awake. The more vain, if not rational, part of her refused to confront him looking like a dish rag. When they argued, she wanted him to see her as the desirable woman he loved, not an alcoholic wreck who deserved to be walked out on. She tiptoed past Nadal and into the bathroom, leaving the door open a crack to avoid the click of the lock engaging. She didn't hear the creak of mattress springs as she began to run a bath, but still she didn't wait for the tub to fill for fear that he'd soon stumble in. She sat in an inch of cold water and soaped, rinsing off with the handheld attachment. Susan brushed her teeth and washed her face as the drain slurped down the bathwater. With the same towel around her from the night before, she stole back into the room for her makeup bag. Nadal still snored. He was programmed, she realized, to wake to the sound of her voice or his internal 7 a.m. alarm clock. All other noises could be relegated to the part of his brain titled, "Things My Wife Will Handle." That part of his brain was about to get a lot smaller, she decided, stepping back into the bathroom. Nadal would have to earn her forgiveness by playing a much larger role in their family. Susan considered all her demands as she applied the necessary lip gloss, blush, and concealer to mask her hangover. He would have to come home regularly for family dinners. One night per week, perhaps Tuesdays, he would take over teaching Jonah or ferrying Jamal to a late activity, giving her a chance to take a Pilates class or have coffee with Jenny. She wanted a weekly date night, too, to help rebuild their connection. Maybe she'd even sign them up for dance lessons. A smile wriggled from her mouth as she remembered the Roomba classes they'd taken before their wedding. Nadal had possessed admirable rhythm in his hips, more than she'd had, according to the 60-year-old former flamenco dancer who had taught the lessons. Susan recalled teasing that she might lose her 31-year-old fiancé to a flexible sexagenarian, emphasis on the sex. Nadal had in turn joked about his pelvic prowess, rotating his hips like he was twirling a hula hoop and claiming that the blood of famous Egyptian belly dancers ran through his veins. Her smile faded. They'd kidded about infidelity once, as though it were a genetic disease from which they'd been spared instead of a wild virus. She still couldn't believe that the man slumbering in the neighboring room had been infected. A stinging behind her eyes warned her against applying mascara. She examined her dour expression in the mirror, emphasized by the damp, dark hair hanging to her shoulders. "It's not going to get any better than this," she told herself. She steeled herself with a minty breath as she re-entered the bedroom. "Nadal, wake up." At the sound of her voice, he murmured something and reached further into her space on the bed. "We have to talk." He pawed the air beside him, and then, feeling nothing, finally rotated toward the sound of her voice. His eyes opened like blinds, pulling back in segments until she could see his dark pupils expanding in the dim light. "Good morning." He yawned and stretched as he sat up on the mattress. "I didn't sleep well. What time is it?"
"Time to talk about that email."
Nadal dragged his fingers down his nightly beard. He let his hands fall to his thighs and slowly got to his feet.
"It's work, honey."
He lumbered toward her. As he passed, he patted her on the shoulder.
"I'd rather not ruin the vacation over it."
She watched him clomp over to the sink and splash some water on his face.
"You already ruined it when you slept with Rachel."
Nadal turned around like he'd been backhanded.
"What?"
She wrote about how she doesn't get involved with neighbors. She thinks you both can come to an arrangement as long as you don't tell your spouses. You've been avoiding her since it happened.
Nadal blinked at her. It's about a lawsuit.
How could he continue to lie? Her empty stomach churned with emotion and the prior night's poisons. She could be sick again.
I'll show you, he said.
He hustled into the bedroom, adjusting his boxer shorts with one hand as he flipped back the laptop screen with the other. The screen flashed its demand for a password. I already read the email, Nadal. Typing responded. He carried the device over to her, supporting it with his left palm while tracing his right index finger over the trackpad. She leaned back against the wall, needing support to continue standing in her dehydrated state.
She's suing me. Look.
He rotated the laptop screen to face her. Instead of an email, she saw a PDF of a formal legal document. Centered at the top of the letter was the law offices of Rachel Klein, along with her business address, email, and phone. Beneath the header was a list of the other parties that had received the mailing, along with their respective contact numbers. Susan recognized the style of the form before even reading the bolded regarding line. It was a notice of intent to sue.
But that email,
Susan stammered, her mind too busy reconciling Rachel's words with the new information to properly articulate. Could Rachel have meant that she typically didn't sue her neighbors and that she wanted to keep the case from their spouses so as not to ruin the trip? Or had Nadal met her to discuss the issue and one thing had led to another?
But you've been acting cagey around her.
Nadal snorted.
Yeah, she's targeting my company. That's not something friends do as far as I'm concerned. And she's been trying to corner me to discuss a settlement this whole trip.
He released the laptop into Susan's waiting hands.
Read it. You'll see.
The relieved tears clouding her vision wouldn't let her make sense of the screen. Susan looked above it to see her husband's sheepish smile. He was embarrassed for her. She'd gone crazy over a questionably worded email, shouting at Nadal and making him shut down rather than explain the whole story. She was all the bad words that she'd thought about Rachel and worse. Susan winced at the memory of her drunken email. She owed Rachel an apology, though not as big a mea culpa as she owed her husband.
I'm so sorry. I'm such an idiot.
She stared at the wavy letters on the screen instead of facing Nadal. If he'd accused her of cheating, she'd have been full of righteous anger and indignation. But he stood in front of her, looking sad for both of them.
God, I'm the worst. I'm the absolute worst.
Shame mixed with the relief and unspent anger in her bubbling stomach, giving her new reason to be sick.
I've been drinking too much, clearly. That's no excuse, but I'm going to cut way back on the alcohol.
Well, that might be good,
Nadal said. The quick agreement suggested to Susan that he had considered talking to her about her wine consumption before.
Better to stop a problem before one really takes hold.
Nadal ran a hand through his dark curls.
It's not all your fault, though. I've been working so much and then acting secretive on top of it. I can see how you'd be concerned.
He sighed. I should have told you right away. Rachel got this personal injury case a month or two ago, I guess,
but she only recently realized that she could rope in Doc to go. She met with me about it Tuesday afternoon, completely blindsided me. I thought she was coming to offer her legal services or to consult, since everybody I say hello to in our new town tells me I need to put them on the payroll in some capacity.
He shook his head.
You'd think people didn't have jobs before I showed up.
Susan felt even worse.
She'd been nagging her husband to befriend the neighbors, and they'd all been trying to shake him down for money.
I'm so sorry.
Nadal shrugged, as if to say he'd expected as much once his firm began doing well. He started back toward the bed.
I'm sorry you worked so hard planning this vacation, and she would do this right before we left.
He plopped atop the mattress.
It didn't even occur to me how her email could be read, because I knew what it was about. But in hindsight, she really does have a messed up way with words. I can't walk away now. Keep this just between us.
He rubbed a palm over his face and then held it out toward her.
I get why your first thought wouldn't be that the neighbor was taking us to court.
Susan dropped onto the duvet beside her husband and leaned miserably into his side.
But it shouldn't have been cheating.
She fell backward onto the mattress, letting the fluffy fabric envelop her, wishing she could sink into it and disappear.
I suppose I've been feeling self-conscious since leaving my job. More of my self-worth was tied up in my paycheck than I realized. I'm just... ugh.
Nadal laid down beside her and slipped his arm beneath her neck. He pulled her into him, letting her nuzzle into his chest.
You're not ugh. I'm to blame also. I shouldn't have kept this from you.
I understand why you did, though. You thought you were helping me have a nice vacation.
She groaned.
I am so sorry.
He kissed the top of her head. You said that already.
She pressed her face between his pectorals, letting his chest hair tickle her nose. How can I make it up to you?
Nadal's fingers pulled through her wet hair.
I don't know. Sex?
Susan pressed tighter into her husband, letting the towel slip below her breasts so that her bare skin touched his naked torso, hoping it would be enough for the moment. The emotional roller coaster she'd been riding was poor medicine for a hangover. Her stomach still debated whether it wanted to keep down the water from earlier.
I drank myself into a stupor last night, she mumbled. I can't bounce around too much right now.
Nadal's chest shook as he laughed.
Oh, babe.
Another kiss landed on her forehead. He rolled over and got up from the mattress, leaving her half naked on the bed.
Actually, I could use your help with the case when you feel up to it. We have our team looking at it, of course, but they're all Valley lawyers used to thinking that everyone plays by Facebook rules. Think fast and break things. We're in New York now, and I think a criminal defense attorney might be more accustomed to critically examining culpability.
The request reinflated some of her self-esteem, enabling her to sit up and take a deep breath, which she immediately regretted. It threatened to make her retch again.
Fresh air might do me some good. Talk me through it on the beach. We can watch the sunrise.
Nadal grimaced.
Is that early?
There's no sleeping beside a wall of east-facing windows.
Is it a nude beach?
No.
Nadal kissed her shoulder.
Then I guess we should both get dressed.
Susan sucked in salt air and stepped onto the sand. The aroma, coupled with the cool breeze, eased her nausea. Holding her husband's hand also helped settle her churning stomach. The pressure of his fingers between her knuckles made her feel less sick with herself for her terrible mistake. He was a good man, and he loved her. She could take confidence from that. They walked slowly, pacing themselves to the sunrise. During the time she'd taken to get ready, a golden circle had peaked above the horizon line. To Susan, the sun's face resembled a godly child peering above a rippling navy blanket. She missed her kids.
The case involves a 9-year-old boy.
Nadal looked straight ahead at the jetty looming in the distance. That was a difference between her and her husband, Susan thought. He was always focused on a goal, while she got enveloped by the atmosphere.
The same age as our twins, as Rachel has reminded me countless times in an effort to horrify me into forking over money. Remember when she dragged me into the house for wine?
Susan stroked the back of Nadal's hand, an insufficient gesture of affection for all the trouble she'd caused.
Anyway, the boy had strep throat.
Nadal cleared his throat, as if for emphasis.
He suffered a fatal allergic reaction after being treated at home by a doctor contacted through Doc2Go. Apparently, the kid was allergic to penicillin, and the doctor prescribed amoxicillin, which is basically the same fucking thing.
The epithet drew Susan's attention from the scenery back to her husband. When they'd met, Nadal had cursed often, a consequence, he'd claimed, of his upbringing on the outskirts of Boston and his teenage rebellion against his strict Muslim parents. But he'd reined himself in since having the boys. For Nadal to drop an F-bomb, he had to be pretty upset.
So, okay, he continued, the doctor screws up, says he wasn't informed about the allergy. Fine. Usually there's a second line of defense, the pharmacy. Unfortunately, this boy's parents can't go to their usual place, which has the allergy on record, because it's closed. So they visit a new convenience store to fill the prescription and forget to tell the pharmacist that their son is allergic to the most commonly prescribed antibiotic.
Nadal's stride lengthened.
I mean, what happened to these parents is horrible, and I don't want to vilify them. I really don't. But how do you have a kid with a penicillin allergy and not realize that's what you're giving him? How do you not check?
Susan thought of all the sick visits with their boys over the years. Often she'd been so exhausted from the night of soothing, cleaning up vomit, and forcing down unwanted medicines that, by the time she'd reached the urgent care, she'd forget to tell the doctor anything beyond the past 24 hours. Of course, she hadn't had a kid with a deadly allergy. Still, she could sympathize. For someone with an ill child and no medical training, doctors were akin to gods. The assumption was that they knew everything already.
And the boy died?
I guess the parents gave him the medicine and put him to bed.
Nadal's walk slowed.
The boy's throat closed up, and he couldn't alert them. They woke to find him on his bedroom floor, unresponsive.
Nadal stopped to examine the sand creeping up the sides of his sneakers.
It's all so fucked.
As his wife, Susan wanted to come to his defense. Doc2Go hadn't made the diagnosis. It was the physician's job to ask the family for allergy information and the pharmacist's job to explain the risks of the medication before filling a prescription. Her internal lawyer, however, made her consider the other side. Nadal's company had provided the family with the doctor's information and, by allowing him to use the site, certified his qualifications for the job.
The site asks for allergy information, right? I remember a long questionnaire.
Nadal nodded vigorously.
Of course. The patients have to supply it, just like they would at a hospital.
Did the parents neglect to include the allergy information?
Nadal's hands went to his hips. He shook his head.
Damn doctor didn't read it.
Isn't there a checkbox that doctors are supposed to tick, saying they read it?
It's on the site.
Nadal's lack of eye contact told Susan to probe.
But?
He kicked the sand.
Doctors can see the patient's location and agree to take the case without checking the box first. It's a stupid glitch. We already fixed it.
Susan sucked air through her teeth.
You fixed it?
Yeah, it was a fucking glitch, that's all. We fixed it.
The swear betrayed that Nadal suspected and didn't want to hear what she would say next. Susan looked out over the water, taking a moment to judiciously select her words. The sun's glowing face had moved an inch higher and light stretched toward the shore, indicating that the day was finally serious about starting.
Fixing things could be an admission of guilt, honey.
Susan kept her gaze trained on the horizon. You wouldn't have changed anything if there wasn't something wrong. Nadal tossed his hand, dismissing her argument.
Someone pointed out a user experience issue and we fixed it. That's what we do. It's not because we think we're responsible for every doctor that uses the site.
She understood why her husband felt that way. Technologists were, at heart, scientists. They operated according to the same method. See a problem, develop a hypothesis to fix said problem, test it, note the relative success and complications of the solution, improve the methodology, repeat. Mistakes were part of the process. They didn't fear them as much as they should.
How much do they want?
Nadal picked up his pace toward the jetty, his frustration fueling his speed.
They sued the doctor's insurance for $1 million 6 weeks ago. He apparently responded by putting all the blame on the site, claiming he'd never been alerted to the allergy information, didn't know it was on the application, and hadn't been informed by the parents. Rachel hinted to me that she could make it go away for double that without needing to go to court.
Nadal scoffed.
$2 million. That's 2 years' salary for 5 senior developers. Do you know how much that will slow progress and the profitability timetable? And the payout alone will enrage the investors. The VCs will probably want to move up the IPO so they can cash out before anything else happens. But we'll be less equipped to do that because we'll have spent the new hire budget on legal fees.
Nadal's nostrils flared like an enraged bull as he charged toward the rocks.
I'm sure Rachel told the family that the company doesn't want any bad press before the big dog and pony IPO show, so they feel well positioned to fight. And unfortunately, she's right.
Susan put an arm around Nadal's side and pulled herself close, offering her physical support since she couldn't promise to make anything better. Negative headlines would erase much of the work Nadal had done building up the company's presence and brand on the East Coast. He'd have no choice but to give Rachel what she and her clients demanded. She focused on the water, not wanting Nadal to get worked up from her lack of fight. The pale blue sky was streaked with gold and grayish green. Cirrus clouds swirled high above, adding white wisps to the beautiful painting.
I'm sorry that you've been dealing with all of this.
It's not your fault. It's Rachel. She's fucking shameless.
He snorted.
Do you know she told me that she was helping me out with the suit?
How's that?
According to her, another lawyer, one not tied to our family, would try the case in the court of public opinion. They'd shame the company into a massive settlement for God only knows how much. However, because she knows us and knows how reasonable and, her words, forward-thinking I am, she's certain we can come up with a number that compensates her client for their unimaginable loss without making a big scene.
Susan's inner lawyer couldn't help but feel a bit impressed by Rachel's argument, the way she'd delivered the threat under the guise of friendship. I'll play nice, but only if you play ball. Susan looked up at Nadal and rolled her eyes, trying to make light of the solid intimidation tactic. Remind me to thank her.
Yeah, what a bitch, right?
Susan resumed walking, feeling more guilty with each step. She'd mentally called Rachel that word 1,000 times in her mind the prior night. But the truth was, the woman really hadn't deserved it. She hadn't been a husband stealer, and she also wasn't a greedy monster who had sought out a suit to screw her neighbors. She'd taken the case before she'd known it involved Nadal. Dropping it, simply because she had a burgeoning friendship with one of the named parties, could be considered unethical. And, if Susan were honest with herself, Rachel probably was doing Nadal a favor not involving the press and dampening enthusiasm for his IPO. He couldn't expect her not to seek a multi-million-dollar settlement. Two parents had lost their little boy. Rachel's job was to ease their pain and suffering with as big a payout as possible. I wouldn't be too harsh on her, honey. Rachel can't simply drop a case that she's already been working on.
and $2 million for the death of a child isn't exorbitant. Another lawyer might have just read the hype-heavy business articles and asked for an amount that you'd never be able to absorb with your current resources. They reached the jetty as Susan finished her defense. The wall of rocks pierced the water like an arrowhead. The ocean slapped against it, creating little white crests that rippled toward a female figure reclining against the rocks. Susan startled at the realization that they weren't alone. From the forward tilt of the stranger's head, Susan guessed that she was napping, though she couldn't imagine trying to tan or sleep at such an early hour, and certainly not with the tide creeping in.
Lawyers.
Nadal named the career with more venom than he'd injected into countless four-letter words.
You always take each other's side.
Don't be silly. I'm only saying to give her the benefit of the doubt. Susan shielded her eyes from the sunlight to better see the sunbather. Without the glare, more details became visible. Wrinkled heels, white legs, hair darkened with seawater, pasted to a pale neck. A white bathing suit. She recognized the suit. She'd thought about it more than once the prior night on the couch, torturing herself by imagining it pooled on the floor beside a floral kimono while the pale body it had covered draped itself across her husband's torso.
You really don't see the immorality of...
She nudged Nadal with her elbow. Hi, Rachel, she shouted.
Speak of the devil,
he muttered. He turned back toward the house. Susan braced herself to apologize. With luck, Rachel hadn't yet read her email and therefore hadn't been stewing about it. Susan decided she'd be humble and self-deprecating, taking responsibility while also explaining the mitigating factors of her drunkenness and exhaustion. She might apologize on Nadal's behalf as well, explaining how hard he'd worked for years to bring Doc2Go to fruition and how unnerving it was for him to see his baby sued for the first time. Rachel? Susan called out. A wave crashed against the jetty, spitting water toward her friend. Susan forced her legs forward, despite a deepening sense of foreboding. Rachel! She shouted again. The lack of any response stopped her from saying the name a third time. She dropped to her knees beside the mannequin form. Rachel's chest wasn't moving. Susan knew CPR, but she was in no position to perform it. Already she felt bile building at the base of her throat. She screamed for Nadal. Footsteps beat toward her. Moments later, he was kneeling by her side, pressing two fingers into the skin below Rachel's jaw, shifting her bent head to reveal the paisley print of bruises spread across Rachel's neck. After 10 seconds, he dropped his hand to his lap. Try again, Susan insisted. Maybe it's faint. Nadal pressed his fingers into another spot. He counted only 5 seconds this time. Each one felt like an eternity.
There's no pulse. Her skin is cold.
Susan suddenly became aware of a smell wafting from Rachel, a funky odor, like brackish water without as much sulfur. Sour liquid reared into Susan's throat. She scrambled from Rachel's body on all fours, a crab scuttling toward a hole. Her ears filled with the sound of rushing blood. Susan heaved. Frothy yellow bile poured onto the glistening sand. This was her fault, she thought. She'd fallen asleep, wishing the worst things upon Rachel, praying for the woman to disappear permanently from her life. Such entreaties were never answered by God, and the devil never did anything for free. Part 3. Chapter 24, The Day After. Gabby observed Nadal through the one-way mirror, scanning for signs of the murderous rage required to hold a struggling woman underwater for a full 5 minutes. He didn't exhibit the behaviors that she'd come to associate with violent men caged in small spaces.
He didn't pace like a tiger or compulsively fidget, rubbing his hands over his arms, drumming his fingers on the desk, or jiggling his knees. He didn't close his eyes, retreating to some place in his mind where he was still free. He also didn't cry, as so many did upon realizing that one act of extreme selfishness or explosive anger was about to cost them everything. Instead, Nadal sat at the desk, actively waiting. His eyes, which were alternatively trained on the mirror or his hands, were focused and alert. His palms lay atop the desk in a relaxed position. His feet rested flat on the floor. He didn't appear comfortable. The stark room was designed to make sure he couldn't be, but he didn't seem itching to shed his skin either. Gabby wished she could talk to him. On the advice of his wife, Nadal had declared he would not utter another word without his attorney present. Furthermore, Susan had laid into her husband about revealing the lawsuit, shouting in front of Gabby and DeMarco that he'd made a terrible mistake conversing with the enemy. "The detectives are not here on the side of truth, honey," she'd said. "They're on the side of keeping their community calm and the tourist dollars coming in. They'd prefer, I'm sure, to arrest someone that Rachel knew, because then her killing becomes an isolated incident rather than what it is, a predator roaming the area. And since they lack any evidence to suggest that her murder was at all personal, they're keeping all of her friends in here, hoping to shake us up." Though Gabby had thought Susan's characterization grossly unfair, she hadn't objected to her speech. The woman was entitled to hurl a few unfounded accusations at her. After all, she'd suggested that Susan had killed her neighbor for cheating with her husband. Besides, arguing with Susan would have only riled her up more, and the woman was already strutting around like a rooster in a cockpit. She'd stormed out of the station, swearing at the top of her voice to call Nadal's lawyer and personally sue the East Hampton police for all kinds of damages should they dare arrest her husband on baseless allegations or release one iota of info concerning a yet-to-be-filed lawsuit against a privately held business not at all relevant to their investigation. Gabby had read enough.